Hello, hello, and welcome to The Mental Matchup, a podcast where we talk about one of the hardest competitions an athlete can face, the matchup against their own mind. I'm Kat, and I'm here with my co-host Skylar, and today we are talking to Brittany Todd, a former swimmer at the University of Florida, go Gators, and is now a psychotherapist. Brittany was an extremely competitive swimmer who took part in two Olympic trials, but her career was cut short due to shoulder injuries. She dealt with the difficulties of losing her identity as a student athlete and has battled eating disorders, depression, and bipolar disorder. But her experience have given her an extremely valuable perspective on the connection between mind and body and have made her into an unbelievably empathetic and knowledgeable psychotherapist and human. We hope you get as much out of our conversation with Brittany as we did.
Brittany, thank you so much for joining us on The Mental Matchup. I'm really grateful to have you join us because I think you have such a valuable experience both as an athlete and then also now as a counselor and someone who is helping other people. I just really look forward to diving a little bit more into your story and having our audience both learn from your experiences with mental health, your experience as an athlete, and then your experience now helping other people. So for starters, we usually like to give people some context into who you were at an earlier age, kind of what got you into swimming and what your childhood looked like.
Oh gosh. Well, first, thank you guys for having me. I'm so excited to be a part of this. You have no idea. This is something that I've not really talked about, honestly, probably ever. In fact, I was telling my staff earlier because they were like, what are you doing tonight? And I was like, oh, I'm still here because I get to be on Blake Morgan's Message podcast. This is so cool. And they were like, what are you talking about? And I was like, oh, you know, just the usual crazy version of myself. And, it was such a big deal because it's not something that I broadcast. I use in my practice and counseling a lot of self-disclosure, but I don't talk about it. It is not something that is to my knowledge, talked about around town. So I'm really excited to be here and be able to share some of this.
Well, we're honored that you're willing to share with us tonight and kind of be a part of that initial discussion. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I think this is the perfect time to start this conversation. So it's good. But as far as what got me into swimming, I think it started when I was really young. I remember swimming my grandfather's, well, it was my grandparents' pool, but it was really his because he was in it all the time. And so I remember growing up having that experience with him and just every summer playing in the pool when I was under 10. I started swimming competitively when I was in the second grade. And I remember my mom and my stepfather were on some vacation or something. And when they were gone, I was like, yeah, I don't like this. I'm quitting. And so my dad let me quit and she came back and my mom was like, oh my gosh, you let her quit something what in this world? And I was like, yeah, I don't like swimming. I'm not swimming anymore. And I think I was probably not a swimmer for 6 months. And then one of my best friends started. So then we both dove into it and started, no pun intended. And we started swimming together. And that was kind of the very beginning of my competitive swimming career. But for as long as I can remember, the pool has always been a safe space for me. I mean, at my grandparents' house, we were the members of a pool called the Omni here in town when my parents were still married and after they got divorced. And I was there all the time. I just hung out. I was what they call a pool rat, I guess. And the lifeguards were my friends and they were also my babysitters. And I thought they were the greatest things ever. And then we joined Westwood, which is another club pool here in same situation. And I coached them and all the things. And now my kids are just they're the same. They're following right along. But my daughter, who's in third grade, is adamant about not swimming year round right now. And that's just so on brand, because that literally was me. It's just funny.
Yeah, I swimming was probably my least favorite sport. That is like the furthest thing you could younger. So I just have so much respect for swimmers being able to get 2 days in and spend that much time in the pool. It's pretty impressive to me. So what was kind of the first time that you started to experience some kind of mental health struggle yourself?
It's a really good question that I don't know for sure, but I think it, if I had to guess, it was probably very young. So I have this journal that is from like second and third grade, and I found it in my parents' attic. I don't know, it was a couple of years ago. And it's like little Brittany writing in this journal with cats on the front of it. And I was allergic to cats and still am. So I don't know why there's cats on the front of this journal. But in there is just like, you know, writing about how I didn't feel well. And I thought that I was fat. And I thought that people didn't like me. And I also talked about how sad I was. And I talked about how sad I was that my parents got divorced. And like my dad disappeared for a while after that happened. And I talked about how I missed him and how my mom was like difficult to get along with. And then I like the third grade one is really interesting because it talks about how I had like this like intense feeling and I had this desire to go like just lay down in the mud. And to this day, like, and I can definitely get more into the reason why, but I have this thing where I like to lay down on the ground when it's raining. And so in college, when I was just at the peak of all of this, my roommate came home and like starts to pull in the driveway and can't get into it because I'm laying down in the driveway in the middle of a storm. And it was so interesting to connect that back to like third grade Brittany, where she wanted to like go roll in the mud. So I don't remember feeling all of those things, but I think that that's when it must have started. I know for sure that my eating disorder or eating disorders, if we're going to break it down, really began my junior year of high school. And I very detailed remember standing in my bathroom at my parents' house or my house, and had just come back from a service club meeting in high school where we had just cookies and brownies. And I just had a sweet tooth, still have a huge sweet tooth, and like had just like went to town on these brownies. Unclear as to why I just randomly binged on brownies in like a Wednesday afternoon, but I did. And I got home and I just remember feeling very unsettled and like immediately worried about my body and had to go to practice. And like, sure, I was going to go to practice and burn it all off. And that is what the logical mind says. But my mind immediately went to, now I have to go be in a bathing suit. So I feel really fat and I have to go be in a bathing suit. So naturally my solution was like, well, I should probably just make myself throw up. Not entirely sure where that came from because I didn't have a lot of friends at the time that had like an eating disorder or disordered eating or even knowingly body image issues. But that was where my brain went. And my mom and I are very close and we always have been despite, you know, all the things. But I picked up the phone and I called her and I was like, she's at work, of course. And I'm like, do you think I should make myself throw up? Because I just had like 3 brownies. And she was like, okay, 1, don't know where this is coming from. 2, no, like just go to practice and work it off, which really was probably not what I needed to hear at the time. Decided that that wasn't going to work. So I made myself throw up and that was the beginning of it. And that was when I was like, oh, I can do this. Like this is an option. And it was never something that like I took on, like I didn't just jump in and ever only have an eating disorder. And that wasn't my life, but that was like a solution to so many things. So that's where I think the really intense battle began, but honestly, I don't know, mental health, I think, has probably been some level of this chemical cross that's been in my brain since I entered the world. So in some way, or actually not in some way, literally, it is a huge theme in my life. And for now, it just kind of comes from a bunch of different angles where I can help create awareness and help people with their mental health, but like I'm always treating mine and always learning more about myself. That was a really long answer.
I'm so interested to hear about like laying in the mud and then laying on the ground, because I know grounding is like a thing. I have like a grounding mat, and like I'll ground sometimes when I get overwhelmed. Is that like part of it? Do you think that it, did you do it because it made you calm, or
do yes. you
even, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was 19, this is very complicated, but when I was 19, I had I think my first surgery, and was just all over the place and was like very unhappy and could not ever like calm myself down. Was like doing hours and hours of cardio in the weight room at Florida, and I was miserable at the same time. So I went and saw the like team doctor, who, you know, was supposed to be like a gynecologist and a psychiatrist and your primary care. And like, he's like jack of all trades. Like, he's specialist for everything, apparently. And he was like, I believe you are bipolar. And I was like, no, I'm just like, I'm not, that's not a thing. Nope. And he was like, well, I think that you are. And I think maybe we should try this medication. And I was like, that's a hard no for me. Because of course the side effect was weight gain. So I was like, okay, that's not an option at all. Regardless, because it was like really not feeling well, I took it, and Paxil is an SSRI, and it made me manic. And we lived in this house, like me and a couple of other girls who were also on the swim team had moved into a house at this point. And I was just like mentally and emotionally and physically like out of control. Like, I couldn't swim unless I was like in the flume or something like that, or vertical kicking. And I could vertical kick so hard. Like, I had scars on my feet from fence, and I still do. And I mean, it was just a whole thing. So I started running, and I would run this like huge, like 8 mile loop around our neighborhood. And I just like in Florida, like terrible storms. And so one day I was like running all the way back, and I just like, all I could think about was wanting to lay down, and I wanted it to rain so bad. And I also really wanted watermelon, which is just a whole, like, I have no idea why, but I have this like attraction to melons. So I was really thirsty, and I was really, really like chaotic. And it starts raining, and I get to the house that we were living in, and I'm like in my sports bra and shorts, and just decided that I was gonna lay there. And it proceeds to storm, and it's like lightning, and there's and thundering, and like absolutely pouring. And I will never forget that moment. Not that there haven't been like many more, but that was the first time I'd ever done it. But like I like lay down on the concrete and could see like these giant raindrops like coming at me. And maybe it felt like I was underwater, I don't know. But it like stimulates your senses in this way where like everything feels really cool. This is probably part of this is a bipolar manic thing, but it also is grounding at the same time, and it like calms me down. Like it was as if somebody just like pushed on my brain and was like, okay, you need to stop. And despite the fact that my roommate then pulls into the driveway and thinks that I have 100% lost my mind at this point, and she was like, well, it's confirmed, like there she goes. I felt better. And so I kind of developed this weird coping skill of doing that. And like now I choose to lay down on the trampoline in the backyard versus the driveway, because I feel like that would be setting a really bad example for my children because we don't play in the street. But it works still to this day. And I tell people that all the time when I'm working with them, in the sense of like our coping skills are not necessarily ones we can Google. They may be ones that are so random and seem wild and like borderline inappropriate, but they work. And, you know, like when you have panic attacks, when you feel chaotic in your brain and you need a change of senses, the best thing you can do is immerse yourself in something that simulates all of them. And we all know that rain has a certain smell and it has a sound and it feels a certain way against your skin and it tastes a certain way. So it's an opportunity for you to stimulate all of your senses and create a shift. And although I've never tried it, I would imagine that mud works the same way.
I can, yeah, that makes complete sense to me. I think next time it's raining, I'm probably going to do that.
You'll have to let me know how it goes because I think it's the best thing ever.
Yeah. I feel like I've done that in the shower, like with the, yeah, that's kind of similar. Mm. Yeah.
So I do it in the shower too, occasionally. There's something different about the rain because like when you look up and you have like this huge sky, all of the space allows you room to breathe.
Yeah. I can see that. Sorry, go ahead.
In mental health, I think we often or too often feel trapped in our minds. So allowing yourself to actually like visualize, not even visualize, like literally see an infinite amount of space while stimulating your senses allows for your brain to relax and realize that there is something bigger than you. Because when we feel really in our head and we feel really anxious and sad and conflicted and mixed and all of those things, we feel like we're the only person in the world. And there's always something bigger. But sometimes you literally have to lay down and put that in your face. Mm-hmm. But the shower definitely works. And I tell people to get in the shower all the time. Cold showers.
Yeah. When it's not raining, that is a good, good second best. I would love to come back to your doctor in college. And I think you said it was a man. So him giving you that diagnosis.
Yes.
Had he had any interactions with you, meaningful interactions that, you know, sorry, it was unclear to me whether or not you felt that that diagnosis was valid.
Yeah, such a good point. So I think that I knew it was valid, but I used the frustration with the fact that like he didn't know what he was doing. How could he, you know, to just like completely discredit him. To his credit, his name is Dr. McDonald. He's fantastic and probably actually is an expert in everything because he works with athletes and we are, as we know, like just our own breed. And yes, he had had multiple interactions with me for various reasons, typically because I had run myself into the ground since I got there. Like, I mean, guys, I fell out of my chair in the alcohol awareness athletic meeting because I was hungover and because the room was like spinning. It was the second day of freshman orientation as athletes at UF. And we'd gone out that night and I just had just completely lost control, true to form, because I just lived very big and fell out of my chair. So that was the first time I had any interaction with him after that, you know, just to like have my checkup and make sure I was okay. And then after that, it was just like, my shoulder was always in pain. So I got like Toradol shots in my butt all the time. To try to continue to push me, which in hindsight probably was not the best plan. But I went for it because it was a quick fix and allowed me to keep moving.
Yeah. Just to clarify for our audience too, Toradol is that really intense kind of painkiller medication, right?
Yes. Toradol is a really intense anti-inflammatory.
Okay.
So a lot of times it's given as like a subcutaneous shot, or even into the biggest muscle, which would be like your glute, that would decrease inflammation and decrease your pain response. so that you could, from what I have now learned, and continue to re-increase this inflammation. But I mean, it worked, and it, for the way I've now been able to reframe it, probably allowed me to continue swimming and continue moving through the shoulder pain longer than maybe it would have, who knows. But that was a lot of my interaction with him before. He, that being said, probably watched a lot more than I realized he did. I mean, he would see us before swim meets. He would send his trainers, that I'm sure were his mini spies, with us on away meets and stuff like that. So I think it was, I felt like I was hiding things really well, but I know that we don't hide things as well as we think we do sometimes. I also was just in extreme denial, because any thought of having something wrong with me in that sense qualified as an imperfection. And that wasn't an option ever. And it, not that my parents made it be like required perfection, but they definitely encouraged perfection. And that just made me push myself even harder for that perfection. So any label or diagnosis or crack, I felt like was an imperfection. But yeah, I mean, my freshman year was hard, and everyone saw it. I mean, everyone saw it. There's no way it was hidden. I gained weight. I lost a ton of weight. I did not swim well at NCAAs at all. And I got yelled at on the pool deck in front of the Stanford swim team that I had gained weight, and that's why I had not performed well. I was posed with the question of what moves faster in the water, a paddle boat or a canoe? Now, obviously a canoe, and canoes are smaller than paddle boats. So that was that. And that was just all I needed to continue to like propel myself forward. And that summer after my freshman year was really hard. And then we had trials, and at Olympic trials, we were in California that year. And I was so excited because I'd like lost all of the weight and allegedly achieved all of the goals going into it, that I was going to swim well, but I was not healthy enough to swim well. And shoulder pain was definitely a thing. Nutrition was definitely an issue. And depression was an issue at that point, because I had, tapering was my kryptonite. I hated tapering. And for everyone who's listening, tapering is like where you decrease your amount of training to rest for a swim meet or rest for an event. In my case, it was a swim meet, but I hated it because I didn't know how to control my mind while we were doing something like that. I had too much space and too much energy, and I didn't know where it should go. So I felt less productive and less accomplished, and my self-worth is directly attached to going to swim practice and performing in practice. And when that wasn't there, I felt depressed. So a lot of times, at least at this point in my swimming career, I felt depressive going into swim meets, and I didn't get that same adrenaline rush for some reason that I did in high school. And now from my clinical perspective, we know that as I got older, my brain chemicals just apparently perfectly aligned to equal bipolar disorder. And that's where I was. I just didn't know it. And it's great in its own way now to have a label and have a reason, because when you go into Olympic trials as a successful University of Florida athlete and you feel depressed, it like doesn't make any sense. I mean, you know, I think we can go through the checklist all the time and like our everything on paper looks really good. And I looked really good on paper that time. It really did. But I felt so bad. And that, I mean, it showed. And so I don't think I ever really came back from that. And it was after that that I was diagnosed bipolar by Dr. McDonald. And I knew as soon as he said it, I think I'd probably known my whole life. And like looking back, there were times where I identified with characters in movies or TV shows or books that also exhibited a lot of those symptoms. And but I had just pushed it off, I guess, you know, plus like it's not really diagnosed until you're that age anyway. But I'm pretty sure when you're in third grade and you want to go roll in the mud, that's a little bit of a sign.
So you were diagnosed and then you got put on, I forget what medication.
So I got put on Paxil, and a lot of times that like line of medication, which is called an SSRI, it works with the serotonin in your brain, can trigger a hypomanic to manic response or episode in somebody who's bipolar. So that's where things really, like, I never really understood if like that was a test to see if it actually was or whatever, but oh, y'all, it did not end well. It made me so high energy and so chaotic. And so, needless to say, after the laying down in the driveway incident, I just like continued to spiral with no sleep and, super impulsive. I mean, we had just moved into this house like that we were living in, and we flipped it for all intents and purposes. We pulled up the carpet and bleached the floors, and I wasn't swimming at the time because I had had surgery, and everybody would go to practice and they'd come back and I'd be like literally bleaching the floor. Like that actually happened. I stenciled the ceiling in the hallway. That was also a thing. It looked really cool though, but I could not control myself. I could not sleep. I could not do anything. And that was pretty much confirmation at that point, but I hid it all. And so I stopped taking the medication, and really don't think I saw Dr. McDonald like at all anymore, except for maybe an isolated sinus infection. And, that was that. Like it just spiraled from there. I was not compliant with any type of medication ever until, full disclosure, probably the last like 3 years, 3 or 4 years. I was just always in denial and thought I could fix it. And that, like, as athletes, we're taught, like, and I'm not, you know, and as any kind of achiever, right, we're taught that, like, we can do this. I mean, the general, like, feel of the world is that we're not supposed to have challenges and what, like, that may require us to need extra help in any way, shape, or form, you know. My daughter is dyslexic, and I just switched her to private school literally 2 weeks ago because public school is basically telling her that she doesn't need any extra help. She's fine. She's figured it out. But this is the message that like our world is given. And as soon as I was given a label when I was, you know, young, I thought that that meant that I needed extra help and nobody could know about it. So, I mean, I acted out totally. Like I made it through another year. I came back after that surgery. I started swimming again, I guess, like later that spring. And then I was allowed to go home that summer. And, but the expectation was that I was to continue like basically over-exercising and come back even skinnier, because of course I'd gained weight from surgery. And I came back in August and immediately it was just, you know, I'm pretty sure like I'd been some level of hypomanic all summer, and then I came back and had not had enough nutrition. At this point, I was making myself throw up. I was restricting calories. I was taking laxatives. That was a really terrible thing. And same exact swim meet as the year before, where I like injured my shoulder, but it was the day before we were leaving for the Florida Georgia swim meet. And I did a flip turn and I pushed off the wall and my shoulder dislocated like in the water. And my friend, Leah Retrum, who also swam for UF, who was like just the most amazing person. She was in front of me and she is the only one that really saw what happened and like the pain, because it popped right back in, thank goodness. So I was able to, well, thank goodness, but also not, because then I was able to fake it. And Coach Martin Wilby, he's one of the coaches, so I think he still is, walked over the pool deck and he's like, hey, like, what's going on? And I was like, oh, I'm like a little sore. I think I'm in a vertical kick. So I did. And then the next morning we were supposed to leave for Georgia. And you guys know, like, we can only have so many practices in a week or whatever for NCAA. And so, you know, it was not an organized practice. It was like, oh, by the way, we're going to lay this out on the pool deck. Do it if you want to, sort of situation. And like perfectionist Brittany, wild, but perfectionist Brittany was like, of course, any other time would have done it like to a T and would have done it better than everyone else in my head, at least. Not this time. I was like, okay, we're gonna have to just like literally pretend like I'm fine. And I put my fins on and like used that as my excuse to hide it from the rest of the team. Cause I was like, oh, I just, you know, I'm just using my fins cause I want to be ready for the meet, you know, given my shoulder situation. I could not even put my shirt on. I could not brush my hair. It kept dislocating. I could not keep my shoulder in the socket. It was awful. I will never forget walking from the parking lot, like down the sidewalk to the pool where like the bus was before we left that day. I could not hold my bag. Every three steps, it would like start to move and then it would just like freeze. And it was awful. And it would like shoot. You'd have this pain that would just like shoot through your whole body. And I refused to tell anyone. And we were on the bus and Caroline Burkle, who also swam for UF, and she actually swam in the Olympics, I think in 2008. And she's awesome, huge mental health person too. It's my plug for her. She's like a beautiful person. And she was so sweet and like could see that I was in some level of pain. And we had gotten really close in the dorms like the year before, because she realized that I was depressed then too. And she and I would meet on the bathroom floor every now and then, which was like connected our two rooms, and just like cry. So I think she could see that I was in pain. So she gave me like this little back massage the whole way on this bus. And I still don't know. So hopefully she listens to this, but I don't know if she ever knows like how much that comforted me, because I realized that like somebody cared and at least noticed. But because of course in my head I just, you know, didn't think anybody saw either. But anyway, got to the meet. I faked it. Luckily, I ended up having my own room, which was weird because we normally like all room together, and you know, but I guess like we were one odd person out, and so I was the odd one. I was like, okay, good. I'll be in this room. I can hide it from everyone. And the next morning we go to warm-ups at the meet, and I yet again hop in the water, push off the wall, and it dislocates. And this time like it didn't go back in. So Ryan Lochte and Brian Hartley, obviously guys on the team, like, which if you're going to be rescued, like, come on, but great. Like, helped me like claw like on the lane rope like all the way to the wall and get out of the water. And that was the last time I swam for a team. I mean, I swam when I was pregnant. I tried to make a comeback at one point thinking that I was going to qualify for Olympic trials again. That was another probably a mood phase situation, but yeah, that was the end of it all. And it was so abrupt and so unexpected, but also expected, and triggered by so much mental health and so much pressure and perfectionism and lack of awareness and who knows what else that all combined into this one equation where I pushed off the wall. So I don't even know what question I was answering, but that's where I got to. That was the end or the beginning.
Yeah. What happened after? I don't know if like the right way to phrase it be like you lost swimming, but I'm sure in some way, you know, you did lose a part of you, one of the biggest things probably in your life. Like what was the next steps? Did you stay on the team? What can you walk us through that?
So yeah, of course. After that, we, you know, it was horrible. We rode the whole bus home. I remember crying the entire time. My boyfriend was with us on the team, and he at the meet, and he like sat beside me, but I did not speak the whole time. We got back. I think in my head, I knew it was over, but wasn't ready to like accept that yet. We got back. I met with the orthopedic surgeon, the orthopedist, and he said to me, if you want to carry your children when you get older, you're gonna probably need to stop. You really need to consider ending your career. And I was like, what? Like, I think I knew in my heart, but that's hindsight, that's easier. His name was Dr. Wright. He was right, let me tell you. But I just not know what to do with that. So I didn't tell anyone, naturally, for a couple of days, and pretended that like I was feeling better and I was doing dry land and all of the things, but I really was like barely leaving my room. And one night Coach Troy called me and he was like, I want you to come in and meet tomorrow. I was like, okay. So I was like a Wednesday, maybe I went in and met with him and he was like, I want you to go home, like home and spend the weekend with your family. And I want you to really think about things. And I want you to come back and let's talk about what we're going to do. So I went home. I saw another doctor here in Winston who like sees a lot of the Wake Forest football players. And he was like, you're never going to be able to swim to the caliber that you swam at. And you're also could set yourself up for a lifetime of pain. And I was like, okay. So I sat with that like all weekend. And I was terrified because one, that was my identity. I literally grew up introducing myself as Brittany the swimmer. That was my sport, but also my social life and my self-worth and my best friend. And the thing I was good at, like, I didn't even know that I could even be good at anything else other than like running maybe, but like not life. I didn't know I could actually be good at life. Like I, at that point really, like probably did not even know how to do laundry well. So I was just like broken. And I mean, flew back home. I mean, I went home probably Thursday to Monday, flew back home. I met with Coach Troy on Tuesday in his office. And it was really hard for so many reasons, but it just seemed so simple in that office and that conversation. It was like a 30-minute conversation that wrapped up an entire career. I never really remembered much about it. Like, I don't know really what I said or what he said or why it was so short or how it could possibly, how can you wrap like almost 20 years of a sport, well, 15 years of a sport up into like a 30-minute conversation. But needless to say, that left me with very little closure. The days and weeks after that, I just remember crying. Like, I felt so chaotic yet again, and I had all this ridiculous energy and nowhere for it to go. I remember like waking up during the night and never going back to sleep and having like night sweats and just feeling like absolutely terrible. Like my entire world was over. It was one of the most intense feelings of grief ever, to the point that like, I mean, I did not want to be here anymore. I could not imagine life without being Brittany the swimmer. Like there was no identity. There was no future. There was like, what was I going to do? Like I don't know that I had ever really seriously considered a profession. Like it was just this huge wake up moment, but also huge. Like I got hit by a Mack truck and I literally cannot get off the ground. Something shifted and there's so much of this time, and this is like mental health at its best, that like is so gray to me. And it's very hard to like piece together, but I know that like something shifted and like the survival instinct of like, I'm going to fix this came out, which ended up ending just as bad. But I was like, okay, well, I'll find a job. That's what I'll do. I'll find a job. I'll make money. Somehow this resulted in like me applying for all these random like retail jobs and like constantly calling my parents to tell them about it and like trying to listen to their voice to see if this was something that they'd be proud of me for, because I knew that like swimming was a huge part of their life, of course, too. But also as soon as I like made that decision to not swim anymore and to be done with my career, it felt like they did not love me as much. And it felt like they weren't proud of me and like they didn't have anything else to talk about like to their friends when it came to me. Like it would always be like, oh, Brittany's swimming, or she's got a swim meet this weekend, or they're going to be at NCAAs and yada, yada, yada. It was always the, like the bragging rights, you know? And so like, there were no more bragging rights. There was nothing to brag about at that time. And I mean, really, like, I didn't believe there was either. So, you know, it was just like this ridiculous ping pong, and like no pep talks were involved. It was so dark. It was just so dark. And I made it to class. I don't really know. I made it to all of them. At this point I was like 21, I think. So there was like a lot of partying and, a lot of unhealthy relationships and just a lot of isolation. In theory, to answer your question, I was on the team, but I didn't do anything with the team. The thing about athletes, and I was just as guilty, is that like, if we're not in things together, we often forget about each other. And when you're somebody that like, is on the outskirts because of an injury or because of whatever, you literally feel forgotten. And I felt forgotten. And honestly, I kind of think I probably was. I isolated myself, but there was nobody like reaching out and being like, hey, why are you isolating yourself? Like, just because you're not in the pool with us doesn't mean we don't still think you're awesome. Like, that was never happening. Mental health was pretty much ignored all the time. At one point I was forced to go to like this counselor. Her name was Roberta. And she sat across from me like with like her little notebook at her desk and just like took notes the whole time and like barely talked to me. I went to my like 6 sessions and checked it off so that, you know, UF wouldn't be able to be sued by me or something. But that was it. Aside from that, there was no encouragement for the team to reach out, like just absolutely nothing. So because I was searching for endorphins and because I'm me and had literally no boundaries with pretty much anything that I ever did, and probably to some degree still do, I dove really, really hard into party life, and I could drink better than anyone. And I could dress better while I was drinking in my head. And I could stay up later than everyone. And I could go to all of my classes, do all of my work, and show up at that party well dressed. And I think I just went through the next like 2 years with like beer goggles on, for lack of a better description. I did not want to think about how I felt. I didn't want any extra spare time. I didn't, like, if I was not like drinking or smoking weed or in class sort of, then I was like working. And it was like during this period where I tried to start to fill the void from so many other angles, and like took on way more than I could actually do to try to find some level of happiness. So I was just chasing it from like every element. I tried to coach the Buchholz High School swim team. So maybe they'll listen to this and actually realize that I was sorry, but I tried to coach the Buchholz High School swim team in Gainesville, Florida. And I had every intention of like doing that well, but I couldn't emotionally handle it. And their state meet was at the Y National Pool, which was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And it was my favorite pool. And that was like high school YMCA swimming is like, that was my jam. Like, I have the best memories of that. That team is still like, still some of my best friends. Like, that coach, he's just my everything. So when we pulled up on that bus at that pool, and I was supposed to be in charge of all of these kids and like make that and like cheer for them and like coach them and like do all of the things on the side of the pool deck, not in the pool, I got off the bus and threw open the trash can. And I had to be like, I barely made it through that swim meet. And Coach Anthony Nesty was there coaching for another high school swim team. And he's a phenomenal coach. He was a coach at UF at the time. I went up to him and I said, I'm not doing well. And he brushed it off. And I'm sure he would never, ever do that again, because we've all learned so much about mental health since, you know, what, 15 years ago. But that I barely got through that weekend. And that was pretty much it after that. I was just really, really depressed again for a really long period of time, but you really couldn't tell because I showed up at the parties and I drank. And when I was drunk and stuff, I'm sure I was like smiley and dancy. And I did plenty of renditions of Coyote Ugly on the bars. And I ran a lot. There was one bright spot during this entire thing where I joined this gym that was completely off campus, and they had this dance class called Dance Attack. And I danced like growing up until I was 17 at Academy of Dance, where my kids dance right now, my son too, and he's so cute. He's 6. But anyway, so I started dancing there and did these dance classes, and they like brought me back, like in like at least just a glimpse of me. And I mean, just this random dance class with probably like, you know, I was what, like 21, 22 at the time. And like, I'm just chilling in there with like 40-year-olds who can dance really good. And it was like packed and I loved it. And I went every single day. And that little 45-minute dance class like gave me a little bit of hope that I was still in there somewhere. Unfortunately, like, when I graduated and I left, there was no dance class anymore. So then I kind of fell right back. It was just this like vicious cycle, but I searched to like sum up my answer. I really searched for myself for a really, really, really long time. And I would look for myself like through coaching, through assistant coaching, through consulting on pool decks, through triathlons. I went through a huge triathlon phase and did a couple of half Ironman, like just really didn't, that really just didn't work for me. It's fun. Don't get me wrong. It's competition and I'm an athlete. So it's fun, but I was unsuccessful at trying to find myself there. And like at one point, like wanted to be a pharmaceutical sales rep. Like I did not know what to do with my life. Like we were laughing about this last night. Actually, I substitute taught at a private school, the one that I just put my daughter into. There is no world where anybody wants me to be a teacher. Just absolutely none. Like I am not that good of an example. Like, yeah, I didn't know. It would just be terrible. So I'm like substitute teaching. The best part is I substitute taught Spanish, and I like failed Spanish one semester in college because of all the things. So why I was teaching Spanish, I don't know. It was a hot mess. I had 7 jobs at one point, couldn't find happiness in any of them.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
So I looked and I looked and I really just didn't find it until I realized that you can't get rid of part of yourself. So the athlete that I was trying to run away from or redefine or whatever that was never actually left. Like you never actually changed. Like the love that you have for something or someone doesn't ever actually go away. And I tried to fix it and I tried to make it go away. And I did all of these things until I realized that being a swimmer and being an athlete and just being everything that I experienced is never going to go away. And that is part of who I am. And honestly, I think that's literally why we're having this conversation, is because I finally stopped running. And remembered what it was like to be that person. And the fact that I can't be that person on a pool deck or in the water or at a swim meet right now, or and haven't for a really long time, doesn't mean that I'm not still that person. So now I do the same thing. I just do it in different ways.
There's something you said a while back about your parents and when swimming, you felt like there's no longer like bragging rights or that they loved you like less. And that hit home for me. And I'm sure some people listening have people in their lives right now that they might feel like love them less for whatever reason. Is there anything in hindsight or just with like your professional expertise, like that you could give to anyone who might be feeling that way, who it's more so like an internal feeling that they're feeling about themselves? Because I feel like when I've ever felt that, it's not necessarily how I'm projecting how I feel about myself onto how others, I'm perceiving others feeling about me. What would be like a piece of advice to try to like get out of that or look outside of that feeling?
Oh, it's such a hard feeling. And I think you're right. I think that happens so often. And a lot of times we think that we are going to let people down or we're letting people down. And that's really because we feel like we're letting ourselves down. But it's easier to think that we might be letting, you know, somebody else versus ourselves, because the relationship we have with ourselves is the most difficult. But if you're feeling that way, the number one thing I think you need to do is talk to somebody that's not that person. Because it's, we don't believe whatever that person has to say. So if I were to have told my parents, like, I feel like if I stop swimming, you're not going to love me anymore. Or, you know, I'm not going to be worthy of being your daughter, or I'm not going to have an identity or anything. Their answer would have been like, of course we'll love you. Of course. Absolutely. And immediately I'm going to be like, well, that's not true. You know, because I'm going to believe what I want to believe. So talking to somebody that has a completely unbiased opinion and can offer you a perspective that is like just completely off, like out in the distance. Maybe even someone who has been through it themselves, for sure, or someone who can tie it into another element. Like if you're experiencing that as an athlete, maybe they can give you an example of another scenario that these feelings come up, because it comes up all the time. I hear that all the time with grades and with tasks and with relationships and athletics and the pressure we put on ourselves and the identity and the self-worth that we attach can like brings us down more than I think any of us are willing to admit. But you, like I said, like you at the end of the day, no matter what, are still you. And the love for your sport and your what you learn from it never ever goes anywhere. And everybody who loves you will be able to see that. The hard part is being able to see that in yourself. And sometimes that takes a while. But ultimately, no one's gonna love you less.
We're gonna take a quick break and we'll be back with Brittany in a second. We'd like to take a moment to talk about Morgan's Message, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Morgan's Message is a nonprofit founded in 2020 to honor Morgan Rogers, who is a beloved daughter, sister, and fiercely loyal friend. Through amplifying stories, resources, and expertise to confront student-athlete mental health, Morgan's Message is building a community by and for athletes and providing a platform for advocacy. Morgan's Message strives to eliminate the stigma surrounding mental health within the student-athlete community and equalize the treatment of physical and mental health in athletics. To help us take a shot at mental health, to support our mission, or to find out more, head to morgansmessage.org or follow along on Instagram at morgansmessage.
I think a lot of what I've also kind of taken away from our discussions leading up to this call is how important self-love is. So, yeah, could you talk a little bit about how you've managed to find that yourself? Because it sounds like, especially in some of those really dark moments, there was probably a lot of self-doubt and lack of self-compassion. So what are some ways that you've learned to love yourself, practice self-compassion, or some ways that you advise other people to, get to that place?
Yeah. So always a work in progress. You know, I think ironically, this has been like the week of doubt for me. So I can tell you that one of the biggest things that doubt does is it blocks our conscious from our subconscious. And so when we doubt ourselves, it's really hard to love ourselves. It's really hard to believe in ourselves. And our thoughts actually don't communicate, and nor are they rational whatsoever, because one little tiny doubt suddenly becomes like this like earth shattering situation. Self-love is so freaking hard. Like, and I think we have this all or nothing mentality, like, oh, they don't love themselves, or, oh, she really loves herself. Like 100%, I love everything about myself. There's not a thing. There is like, we're never going to 100% love ourselves. It's just not going to happen. You're not going to love yourself all the time. You may love yourself on Tuesday and Thursday, but like Monday, you might be like, oh my gosh, absolutely, I'm out for this. But then Wednesday, you're like, okay, I can tolerate this. But the object of the game is to love yourself more. And so when you feel like you're not loving yourself, maybe taking a minute to list the reasons why other people love you, or why you loved yourself on Tuesday, or why you loved yourself 6 months ago, or what you love about yourself. And if we can come up with like one or two things, then you can usually get some momentum. But loving yourself is so hard, because I think to some degree, there is a level of guilt that's associated with loving ourselves and accepting ourselves when we don't meet these ridiculous expectations that we set for ourselves. And it's okay to accept imperfection, because there is no such thing as perfection. And there is no such thing as balance. There's this like beautiful thing called imperfect balance. If I ever write a book one day, that's what it's going to be called. But it takes a lot, and you have to balance the self-doubt, and you have to balance the fear, and you have to balance self-love, and you have to balance the love that other people have for you and the love you have for them. And somehow it all equals this equation of life. And life is hard, but it's really good. It's a good heart. So as much as you love all of the successes, you have to learn to love the failures also, because that's how we learn.
That was so beautifully articulated.
I'm on the verge of tears. I'm not kidding.
I was just going to say, I wish the audience could see Kat's face right now.
I'm in like a trance. Oh my God, I needed that.
I'm glad.
Wow. Okay. So I feel like we could talk to you forever. But I think that was such a powerful way to wrap up kind of the main portion of the episode. So I think we'll leave it there and start our closing questions. And the first one is, if you could go back to a moment when you were in one of your darkest times, what's one thing that you would say to yourself?
Oh, that question gave me chills. I think what I would tell myself first is that this is temporary. With bipolar disorder specifically, every feeling is temporary. There's always another side. You just have to wait it out. But with any type of mental health, there's always an option. There's always another side. There's always a light. It's just really freaking hard to see that sometimes. So for the girl laying in the driveway, or the girl that couldn't get out of bed, or I don't know, there's been so many other episodes of Dark Brittany, but I would remind her that it was temporary, and that it was going to pass, and that I was going to get through it. Because in those times, in those really close call times, in my head, I didn't know that. I didn't believe that. And so if there could be a bug in my ear, that's what I would have said.
That's one of my favorite. Yeah. Favorite mantras too.
Second question is, if you had one piece of advice for anyone listening who might be struggling and dealing with, you know, their own mental health, what would it be?
So it's cliche, right? But it's the reach out. It is literally the reach out. I think there's so much shame around waving our white flag, but honestly, the bravest thing that you can ever do is ask for help. And this goes for mental health or mental health, but it also goes for like, you have a flat tire on the side of a road. Like if you fail a test and you need tutoring, like the best thing that you can ever do in life is learn how to ask for help. And when it comes to your mental health, if you don't have that, it's really hard to have your feet on the ground with anything else. So in my world, mental health comes first. So we reach out. If you tell a friend can tell somebody else. If you tell an adult, they can get you the help. It does not matter who you reach out to, but it does matter if you verbally reach out. Putting it on social media does not always help you. And so when you feel bad, call and say, I need help, or write a note to somebody, or let somebody know, send up a smoke signal. Either way, reach out and tell somebody you're not feeling good. It's the hardest thing that you would ever have to do, but it is the best thing. And it is the greatest skill, in my opinion, of life in general.
Yeah, I think that's super powerful. And I think from what I've seen, people are getting better and better at that, which does give me a lot of hope. And I think it makes me feel a little bit validated in the work that we're doing and so many people are now doing about reducing the stigma. So cheers to that.
Oh yeah.
All right. Last question is, what is one thing that you're grateful for?
Narrowing that down is so hard. My number one thing that I'm grateful for is that I'm still here. Of course, like the 97,000 other things that I'm grateful for, of course, are my family, and like my kids and stuff like that. But the biggest thing I'm grateful for is that I'm still here and I never gave up and I kept fighting and I have an opportunity to empower other people to do the same and to help show others how to do it and to share my story and to share that with my kids. And I'm grateful that I know sort of how to do this.
Well, I'm really grateful that you're here as well. So thank you. Thank you for staying and thank you for like all the people in your life. I know that a lot of times the support system is a big part of, you know, what makes that possible. But it also sounds like, especially early on, you were a lot of the driving force of making sure that you stayed. So you're amazing. I'm so glad you're still here to help other people.
Thank you. I'm so glad I got to have this opportunity. I agree. I think we could talk about this all night, you know, and think that mental health is invisible and we have to talk about it and we have to reach out and we have to help each other and we have to speak really freaking loud because mental health is normal and it's good and it's okay to have struggles because you'll get through it. So what you guys are doing and this podcast and like literally absolutely everything surrounding Morgan's message and then some is incredible. And you guys are being heard and the people that you have on this podcast are being heard. And it's absolutely amazing and so inspiring. And I'm so grateful for what you guys are doing.
Another huge shout out to Brittany for coming on and chatting with Skylar and I and just being so open, so vulnerable, and just so real with, you know, everything from Olympic trials to being at U of F to her career-ending shoulder injury to, you know, how she helps other in her own clinical practice. I walked away learning so much. And I'm just so honored she came on and talked with us and really shared so many valuable thoughts about the realities of this imperfect but beautifully hard thing we call life. If you want to follow Brittany, you can find her at Be Balanced with Brittany on Instagram. You can follow us at The Mental Matchup at The Mental Matchup on Instagram. And of course, Morgan's Message at Morgan's Message on Instagram or morgansmessage.org. Another huge thank you to Morgan's Message for presenting the podcast and for providing, you know, a place where athletes and student athletes can come and be heard and be seen and feel valued and all of that good stuff. With that, we will see you next episode.